This episode of the Kona Edge is brought to you by Wheel Science. If you're looking for world-class carbon wheels that are UCI approved, come with a lifetime warranty and shipped free worldwide, then check out Wheel Science. Get all the performance at half the price, and when you use the coupon code KONAEDGE at checkout, you'll get an extra 10% discount. To learn more, head over to thekonaedge.com/wheels to find out more, or click on the link in your podcast player now. That's thekonaedge.com/wheels.
This is the Kona Edge, the home of Ironman triathletes who dream of qualifying for the World Championships on the Big Island.
Welcome on to this edition of the Kona Edge. My name is Brad Brown. It's a great pleasure to welcome our next guest onto the podcast as we head to the United Kingdom to catch up with Neil Eddy, who's in Cornwall. Neil, welcome. Nice to have you on.
How you doing?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm super excited to chat a little bit about you and your background and how you got into the sport, but talk to me about the triathlon scene in Cornwall.
Well, actually, if most people that don't know Cornwall say it's sort of we're very much dominated by the coastline and by the sea, so we've got endless amounts of coastline to sea swim, run, trails and coastal path running and everything. It's really it's a great place to be able to train in this area, to be honest.
It sounds like you're taking one for the team, Neil.
Well, some days feels like that when it's endless hills and up and down and wind. And I had another athlete speak to me this morning who's down here on holiday, and he said, "Oh my God, it is windy here." And I was like, "Yeah, that's constant."
Which is not necessarily a bad thing if you're looking at races like Kona, for example. If you're training for Ironman South Africa, where wind does play a part, if you can get to train in it, definitely what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it just makes hitting those numbers a lot easier when you're on the power meter on the bike anyway, and just ride into a headwind.
No doubt,
you've got no choice to hold high numbers then.
Neil, tell me how you got into the sport of triathlon.
I actually started triathlon quite a long time ago. I actually probably did my first triathlon in 2003, and I was about 17, 18 years old. But back then, it was didn't know anything about the sport. It was just a hobby. I came from a background of sport, and I've dominated my life with sport, and now for work as well. So as a young kid, I competed in hockey, football, rugby, cricket, and to a few sports to quite a high level. And swimming was always a sport that I took semi-seriously from a young age, but I was never the most talented, but to county standard, I guess. And then from there, it was my mum that said to me, "Why don't you do one of these triathlon things that they have locally?" And the scene back then was there was only a couple of races around locally, so I would probably go off the back of maybe doing one or two runs, go into a race it off the back of just being fit from sport. Having a hard time to get around and kind of semi enjoyed it. And then I kind of probably wouldn't do anything again till the next summer. So I'd do one or two, probably like we have friends now that do that odd hobby, just a little challenge. And then go from there really. And then probably a few years later after I finished university, cause I was playing water polo to quite a high standard in university, that I then was racing like a sort of domestic elite super series that we had in the UK. And then I realized actually if I started training during the winter that I might actually do okay at this sport.
it's amazing what training does. It's it's weird. It's like, why would you want to do that? Neil, when did you? Yeah, I mean, you've obviously got a very competitive nature. I mean, you mentioned all the sports and I mean, you love being outdoors. You love training. You love what sport sort of represents, but have you always been super competitive? Have you always wanted to be as good as you can be? Or was it, I mean, did you get into it for the fun and then see, or is everything a race?
I think everything's always has been a competition for me, even from a young age, playing games, different things. No, I never enjoyed losing or sort of just taking part in something. And even if it was a case where, you know, I knew I'd be beaten at something, I'd still kind of think, well, there's still a chance I could win. You know, as long as I'm on the start line, there's a chance there that anyone can win an event or win a race. But that competition side of things is what drives me in training. So as much as I'm competitive with everyone else, you have that more competitive nature with yourself to always be improving and compete against yourself, which is probably the biggest competition you can have.
Absolutely. But
all those other sports at a young age sort of drove that forward. So being competitive and understanding sport and that desire to win kind of was developed from all those other sports alongside it.
Where did the interest in endurance triathlon come from? Obviously, I mean, you talk about those, the Super Series. I'm taking it was probably sprint and Olympic distance. Why the long stuff?
Yeah, well, I because I've obviously always worked full-time, and at the time I started working in a school and I'm a PE teacher, and currently I do a job role in the UK, which is called the School Games Organiser, and we have a lot of these across the country, and they sort of do Olympics for schools, and we do lots of competitions that lead up to that. And with that, obviously, I very much enjoy my job, and I was obviously racing at an amateur level, and then domestically kind of on the professional series in a way. And then I think I got to a point where I kind of done everything I could in that distance. And it was a time of maybe stepping up sort of 2014-15 to half Ironman distance. And endurance has always been a big part of me. Even when I was doing sprint distance, I'd never necessarily go any faster for a sprint as I would in an Olympic, but the Olympic would sort of keep going. So I thought I'd try and take that forward to 70.3s and above, and kind of use that base of endurance. And I think even from a young age, I always had such energy and endurance for different sports that I could just keep going. And you know, I never used to have a spare evening as a young kid of things where I didn't have stuff on, and I often went from one sport to another in the same evening as well. So I think that kind of prepared me quite well for racing long distance races later in life.
I'm interested in what you do for a living, and I love the job role that you mentioned. It sounds interesting, and I think it kind of ties into the question I want to ask with regards to the growth of triathlon in the UK particularly. And you mentioned the sort of school Olympics, and this, you were telling me before we started recording, was a program that was born out of the 2012 London Olympics, the sort of legacy program around that. Are you seeing a growth in triathlon in the junior ranks, at school ranks, or is what sort of sporting stuff are you doing? Is it across the board?
We have a variety of sports, and we've even got a new direction in the last year or so, that we're trying to always hit new and young different people, not necessarily those kids that are already competing in sport outside of school. So if there's already an opportunity for them to compete in that sport, or they're already at a good level where they are competing for clubs and recreational, we're trying to hit those other kids that maybe don't get the chance to compete with the school or don't compete outside of school, and trying to entice them into a sport and trying to then give them those big opportunities or something that is a wow moment for them. And then they continue into a pathway into sport for future life. And as you mentioned, you know, this program came about from the London Olympics, and actually we had a funding cut in schools for school sport leading up to the Olympics. But then the new government that changed in, that sort of cut the funding, obviously reinvigorated that financial program and came up with what they call the school games. And there's 450 of me, my job role, across the country. There's four in Cornwall in my county, and we run our different areas. We have a set amount of schools. I've got about 35 schools in my area. So I run competitions for, you know, from 6-year-olds up to 16-year-olds in various sports, really.
What a cool project. I mean, that sounds amazing. And we often talk about on this podcast doing races like Ironman and qualifying for Kona, and just what an example it sets to our kids. And something like that is so important. I mean, sort of modeling active lifestyles for children. I mean, that is one of the biggest issues, I think, facing the youth of today, is just a lack of activity. And as you say, schools cutting sort of sporting programs, it's vital. They might not get to top level sport, but the life skills you learn from sport, you can't get those anywhere else.
No, that's definitely developing in our country over the last couple of years, and that, you know, with the massive obesity crisis that costs multi-billions of pounds in the country, that actually putting in a few hundred million into schools is a drop in the ocean compared to that. So there's actually a bigger direction to getting those physical activity and changing the mindset of you know, parents, teachers, and the children to try and get that physical activity and getting those fundamental skills ready for them, so then they can be lifelong participants in sport or just recreational or keeping active and understanding those healthy lifestyles and the difference it makes to education as well. And sometimes, you know, changing management's decisions on curriculum PE and actually how those kids that are physically active actually perform better in exams and stuff as well.
Yeah, it's all about balance, which is often not what it's like when it comes to Ironman triathlon. How do you get the balance right of what you need to do to be competitive, and then obviously managing a busy life outside of the sport?
Yeah, well, it all comes, I think, like anyone probably listening to this podcast, everyone's got a life to balance outside of the sport, and it is a hobby, but also we all take it, you know, far more seriously than just a hobby. But kind of balancing time and maximizing it. So preparing yourself the night before, getting your equipment ready, making sure you're ready for training in the morning, so you maximize it, so you're not faffing around and losing 10-15 minutes of your training session because you haven't got your swim kit ready in the morning and you're cutting into work time or something. And then it's just kind of having a consistent program, so knowing that each week you pretty much, although your sessions might change, that you're keeping to the same consistency each week of when you're doing your longer runs, when you're doing your longer bikes, and you know that those sessions are coming. And again, preparing the nutrition side of things, so making sure that, you know, your dinner is ready for the next day or your breakfast is ready, so when you get out of the pool, you're on the way to work, you can eat your breakfast and you can set yourself up for the day.
Neil, tell me when Kona first popped onto your radar. When did you first start thinking, that looks good?
Probably when I started stepping up to 70.3 distance. I think before that, I kind of had a bit of an inkling and I used to kind of follow it each year, but not sort of understand the whole side of things. But I might have a little look and have a little guess who might win each year, but without knowing much about it. And then came around to 2016 and I was racing the Maludaba 70.3 champs in Australia, and because we get summer holidays in August, me and my friend were out there training for the summer, and then a few guys from home that were doing a once in a lifetime sort of Ironman, they entered Barcelona Ironman, and they're all sort of in the sort of late in their mid 50s, late 50s, and they were entering it, and I kind of just on the back of coming back from Australia just said to my coach Joel, and I just sort of said, oh, I think I might just dip my toe in the water and enter this Ironman in a few weeks' time and see how things go. And then next year, I'll train for one properly. So he said, that's fine, but when you get home from Australia, you'll have to do a 100-mile bike ride on the Saturday, 20-mile run on the Sunday just to get you ready. You've done a lot of training, but you need to do some of the longer stuff just to prep. So I kind of went into it semi-unprepared, but very naive and maybe a little bit nervous that distance and never running, you know, that marathon before, even a standalone. And I entered Barcelona and became the fastest age grouper and qualified for Kona, and it all sort of rolled into one. So then since then I haven't looked back, and I've kind of just kept entering Ironmans and racing longer distance.
That's amazing. What a cool story. I mean, Barcelona, it's in October, I think. It's beginning of October normally, and it's quite a warm one, it can be quite warm. I mean, I'm not sure how you coped with those sort of conditions. It's obviously nothing like Kona. But, I mean, tell me about that day out. I mean, what was the plan? Was it just to go and finish and you ended up having a blinder, or what happened?
Yeah, I think because sometimes in certain sports I seem to do something first time quite well. Like a standalone marathon, I seem to sort of do it well first time, or a half marathon and do it well, and then it takes a while to then beat that time, because I think I'm sort of managed to just go into it, like I say, naively. But with that race day, it was kind of like, you know, have a strong swim, and that is my background, so I'm always at the front end of a swim group, and then it was kind of just try and be conservative on the bike and just sit maybe with the front end of the race, but if something was too fast for me, just to hold back a little bit. And I think at the back end of the bike I sort of held back a little bit, and we were racing near the professionals as well, because they had a non-wetsuit swim and we had a wetsuit swim, so we were catching those groups up. So when we were in a pace line, you know, sort of 12 meters apart, and it was kind of quite nice. And then yeah, getting onto the run, and I think looking back, I probably took the first 10 miles a little bit too quick and the legs felt good, and then you get is a 3-lap run and you're getting onto the second lap and all of a sudden it's 27 degrees, and I wasn't back then used to racing in too hot a climates all the time, so I was like, oh my god, this is gonna hurt, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. But luckily by the third lap there was the cloud come by, and I was overtaking one of my friends who was just starting his marathon, and he was like, you know, all right, Neil, you must be on your second lap. And I was like, third, you know, sort of just under my breath, because I was like almost finishing the marathon and he was just starting. And I thought, sort of didn't want to tell him that I was almost getting towards the finish line. But yeah, it was certainly an experience that set me up for the following year. And those warmer climates, like you said, to prepare for Kona, but nothing obviously compares you for that big day when you're halfway through a marathon.
Did you go into that race with the eventuality that you could have possibly qualified, that you were going to take a slot, or did it come as a bit of a surprise?
A bit of both, really. I think I probably wouldn't say to anyone that I was necessarily looking at it, but I was thinking, oh, you know, there's a chance that I could get top three, but at the same time, I know what it takes to qualify for Kona, and actually, you know, it wasn't something that was my, you know, main race of the year, and it was at the back end of a season, so it was kind of, if that opportunity come up, then I'd certainly take it. And then when I finished the race, obviously, I was all over that qualifying slot and there the next morning ready to take my place the following year. And it's quite nice to qualify a year out, and you've got the whole year to sort of prepare for it. But all of a sudden that year goes by pretty quickly when you get round to the following season.
I was going to ask it. What do you think is the better way to do it? Do that way? So you're qualifying late in a season, Barcelona as an example, and you've got to wait almost a year for it to come around, or in the build-up to a Kona build, if that makes sense. So you've almost got an Ironman under your belt in that build. So what do you think is the best way to do it?
I think very much depends on that individual. I don't think I've got the right answer yet, because I've not finished on the podium in Kona to sort of say that's what sort of works best for me. But that year, I think maybe I tried not to do too much that season. I did London Marathon early in the year, just to get a good run block together, and that went quite well. And then entered a few half Ironmans and trained away in the summer, and then went to Kona from there. And then last year, Kona was my third long distance race of the year that I'd done. So, I think maybe last year, because I did two Ironmans quite close together, that maybe wasn't. That might not have made me the freshest. So ideally this year, I would enter a race and qualify earlier our summertime, so June, July, and then give us a few weeks off to then put a good sort of 2-3 month block together for Kona this year would be the ideal situation, I believe.
Is this the thing now? Is it a case of Kona's always going to be the A race in the year and we've got to do what it takes to get there and race well on the big island? Or is it, you know what, we'll do it for as long as we can, and if we don't qualify or if something comes up and maybe there's something else, we'll go that route.
It's such a mecca of the sport when you're there. That buzz that you get is second to none. I think that year that I'd qualified the first time, I said, you know, the London Marathon, oh my God, that's the greatest experience I've had. Like, the crowds were phenomenal. You know, 4 months later, I'm in Kona going, oh my God, that is the single greatest thing I've done. And even though I was in a bad way, you know, like most people in their first time in Kona on the run. But I think at the moment, that aim of getting on the podium and having a solid race, I think if I'd had my best race and in Kona and kind of put the run together that I know I can, then maybe I'd debate going back the following year. But at the moment, you know, you leave it a week or two after Kona this year just passed, and within 2 weeks I'm like, yeah, I'm ready to go back next year and kind of really target that race, and until I get my if I get beaten and I've got my best race out there, then that's absolutely fine. But still at the moment, you know, I'm just trying to find those that magic formula on race day to put it all together. And I know in Ironman, you certainly, probably only a few times in your life that you probably get all three disciplines absolutely nailed, but hopefully that'll come round, and hopefully it'll be this year.
You talk about getting them right on the big island. Do you feel like you've got it right in an Ironman anyway, or is there still unfinished business just in an Ironman distance triathlon?
I think we're all, you know, in our sport, we're all quite sort of, trying to think of the word, sort of always analysing our race day. And even when we have a good day, you always sort of think, oh, that could have gone a little bit better, or could have gone a bit past there. But actually, sometimes, you know, that's when you've had your best race days. I don't think I've necessarily hooked up all three in a row yet. You know, last year, sort of I raced Lanzarote and I had an amazing swim and an amazing run split, and had, like, you know, the sort of fifth fastest run of the day out there, but then race Bolton sort of 5 weeks later and finishing six overall was a great race day, but I didn't necessarily wasn't necessarily certain elements of that race weren't as good as Lanzarote. So it's kind of just putting all those together, and hopefully one day that they will give me a super time.
What do you think the secret is?
In Kona, it's just kind of, I think it's the preparation going into it, being able to cope with those conditions and that run course. And even this year, I was like, right, I'm going to set off on that run sort of 15 to 20 seconds a mile slower than I normally would. And I have already this season. And then kind of just trying to survive then for the remainder of the run. And that's what a lot of people won't realize if they haven't been to Kona, is actually, you know, that run course is just like an A&E department. You know, everyone's sort of dropping like flies on the run course, and even the fastest guys in the world, you know, you're looking at them coming the other way. You know, the surviving a run course, they're not attacking it like they would in other races. So they're kind of just getting through and surviving. And I think, you know, I'm able to run low 250s marathon or mid 250s marathon off the bike. So if I could run around that 3 hour mark in Kona, then that'd certainly be a good day for me, I think. And at the moment, I've only managed to sort of get that sort of down to 3:10 in Kona with a lot of walking aid stations.
I mean, that's an incredible run split. What was your standalone London marathon time?
2:34 was my first standalone marathon.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing at all. No.
Well, what makes Kona so tough, Neil? I mean, obviously the conditions, we talk about the wind, we talk about the heat, the humidity. Is it just that, or is there more to it?
You know, it's not an easy run course either. You know, there's lots of run courses out there that are pretty flat nowadays. It is a bit rolling. There's a few little runs in it, little lumps in it as you're going along, but sometimes that's quite nice to get the legs going and a few little ups and downs rather than the flat. But I think it is literally that humidity along that front that, you know, is just so tough to prepare for. And even coming from the UK, you know, you might train away in the summer holidays like myself, and then all of a sudden you come back home and you're training in 12 degrees for a couple of weeks, and then you go out to Kona and all of a sudden it's mid 30s and the humidity is through the roof. But I think even the spectators, my girlfriend herself, you know, standing on the street corner for 8 hours is a tough task in conditions like that.
Yeah, no doubt. What are you in your triathlon career up to now, what are you most proud of?
God, it's a difficult question, actually. I've won some amateur world titles, which I'm absolutely proud of, but I think definitely qualifying for Kona, and sort of even last year not qualifying first time in Lanzarote, and not having a great bike split, not having a great day on the bike, to come back, you know, 3-4 weeks later and enter UK Ironman and kind of take the race by storm there was certainly a highlight, really. But I think it's probably that consistency to keep performing on big race days, which I sort of pride myself on a little bit. You know, sometimes the smaller races locally or something, you kind of just get by, but these big race days, I've always seemed to have that extra edge where I really get myself up for it.
How do you do that, Neil? That big match temperament, we see it so often. Athletes will dominate, like you say, a local race where there's not really big names, but they are head and shoulders above everyone else, and they've got the ability to do really well at a race like Kona or at a sort of a continental champs, for example. But they just struggle. I don't know if it's the pressure. What do you think it is that allows you to have that BMT, so to speak?
I think it's that knowledge of preparation going into it. I think if you're underprepared, or you know you've had niggles or an injury, or you're not feeling great, then you can certainly, you know, when the going gets tough on race day, you kind of have an excuse in the back of your mind where you can shut down a little bit. If your preparation has gone well and you're satisfied with the preparation and the time that you've put into it, and those key sessions, those key race day sessions that your coach might set that prepares you for that big day, you know, when it comes to race day, actually it's easier sometimes, not easier, but feels easier than sometimes those training loads and that fatigue that you're training under. So I think it's a case of being confident and making sure that you're fully prepared going into that race. And it's that temperament leading to race, not using up too much of that energy in race week and kind of just making sure you sit back and trust in the hard work that you've done and your coach has prepared you for, and making sure that those last couple of sessions are sort of just ticked off. And when it comes to race day, just preparing yourself. And I think psychologically, you know, thinking about those race, that race going into it, and thinking about the course, thinking about your nutrition, and kind of just making sure you're fully prepared.
Sounds amazing. You talk about having it in the back of your mind and the mental side of things. How big a role do you think that plays in having that mental fortitude, being strong mentally to be able to push through when your body's saying give up, you've got to keep going.
Yeah, and I think all of us in this sport have a certain percentage of that in us, really strong from the fact that we even compete in this sport and with something so with such crazy distances. And you know, other people look at us now and probably go, "Oh my God, how do you do that?" And I think we all probably looked at it a few years ago, maybe, and thought that, and I did myself. And whereas now you're kind of like, "Oh yeah, it's not too bad." You know, we just tick off the miles. And I think it's a case of just breaking things down, isn't it? And you break down, although you're, you know, you're hurting on the run, or you just take little segments, or you get to that next aid station, or you're thinking about taking that next gel or that next drink, and then you kind of, all right, there's only another 5K to go, or you just break it down into little segments to kind of make it manageable. If you think about the whole task, the whole day, then you certainly will work yourself up and maybe sort of not have your best race. But I think even listening to podcasts over the years, there's certain amounts of psychology in sport that I didn't realize I did myself preparing going into races. Even when I used to race short course races, I didn't realize that, you know, I had friends and family that say, "Oh yeah, well, I don't really speak to you much the day before because you're not really that chatty, you're so focused on the race." And I'm like, "Oh, am I? I didn't even realize I did it, you know. I've got a little bit better now with it, and kind of just make a few more jokes, but I'm definitely more focused on the race and a bit touchy around race day like most people get, I'm sure."
Yeah, absolutely. Neil, what when all said and done, let's say however many years, 60 years from now, we old and decrepit, sitting in the nursing home, what would you have wanted to have achieved in this sport?
God, it's a very difficult question. I think, you know, I've achieved a lot already, and I think if I can keep maybe inspiring some athletes locally and some young athletes that maybe I teach to go into the sport as well and try and help sort of have a legacy in our area where I live, that would certainly be satisfactory for me. But also, as long as I've given it everything in the race day, and if it means that, you know, a couple of years' time I'm no longer to race, as long as I've given everything I can lead into that and I haven't got anything that I regret or races that I regret not sort of performing at or the preparation going into that, then I'll certainly be satisfied. But, you know, it's a case of how long you want to do the sport, and people always ask you that, and it's kind of like, well, actually, you know, to this level for the next few years, certainly, well, I've got that motivation, I've still got that desire to achieve certain goals, and then maybe after that I'll be back on the golf course and playing more golf and training as more of a hobby.
Well, there's definitely more money in professional golf than there is in professional triathlon.
Certainly.
Neil,
I'm stepping up to that level, but.
Absolutely. I'm always fascinated what people think about the sport from outside, people who don't do it. When you tell them you're doing an Ironman, the kids that you work with, they must think you're crazy.
Oh, I think a lot of people think I'm crazy, even my colleagues that I work with, and when you come in on a Monday, like, "What did you do yesterday?" "Oh, I was, you know, just a 15-mile run and a few hours on the bike and 5 hours on Saturday on the bike, you know, what have you done at the weekend? 8 hours of training or whatever it is," you know, it all adds up. But people slowly embrace it and understand it. My girlfriend's parents that started watching me race last year, that all of a sudden, you know, they were like, "Oh, when's the next race? You know, when can we come and support the next one?" And different bits and pieces like that, really. But it certainly is a hard task on the body, isn't it? And just making sure that, you know, you're recovered. But they kind of start to understand that. Or they might start doing the challenges themselves. You know, there's a few of them that maybe enter a half marathon and they go, "Well, it's nothing to do nothing compared to like what you do." And it's like, well, actually it is. You know, everyone has their own challenges. And actually, if your challenge is 5K, 10K, or your first 10K race or anything like that, then, you know, that is a big task. And sometimes the distances we run, we're more used to it, more prepared for it, that, you know, it sort of feels a bit easier than sounds.
But we all started somewhere, and that's the thing we need to always remember, is that it doesn't matter where someone is. As you say, everyone's got their own challenges, and for someone to do their first park run is huge, and it's just as big as somebody doing their first Ironman. It's just the process is the same. Sometimes it just takes longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And those park runs are, you know, phenomenal to be worldwide like that. And we have kids that, you know, some kids that wouldn't necessarily know that are that sporty, that, you know, go along with their parents and complete their park runs and things. And my girlfriend's a primary teacher, so she takes the little ones, and they were going around the park run last week with some little primary school pupils, and some of them taking 45 minutes or whatever. But the fact that they got around at that age, and something that I'd never done at that age. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, the parkrun phenomenon is just amazing. I mean, my little one's five, my youngest, and she's done two, so it's all good. She also, again, it's slow. The one was on a unicorn, which I'm sure is some sort of record. But it's amazing. And I think what that's going to do for, as you say, just keeping kids and people healthy globally is, yeah, as that's growing, long may it continue, because I think it's a great initiative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're getting more sort of knowledge and understanding out there, and a lot more research into, you know, the benefits of that exercise. And I know I was looking at a New York Times article the other day about, you know, how they're actually sort of, you know, the physical activity, how it's actually, you know, how it keeps you younger and the mind and actually all that side of things, which we've kind of, before people would say, but now I think you're starting to get that research that is out there about those healthy lifestyles, and that physical activity is at the top end of that.
Absolutely. Well, Neil, it's been great catching up. I look forward to talking about the individual disciplines, but we'll say that for next time out.
Thank you very much. Have a good one.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge, I want to invite you to check out the Coach Parry Training Club. The Coach Parry Training Club is the essential resource for anyone at any stage of their triathlon journey. Whether you're just starting out in the sport and training for your first sprint distance race, or if you've been around the block a few times and are looking to take your Ironman performance to the next level, then the Coach Parry Training Club can help you. Developed by double Olympic and Commonwealth Games triathlon coach Lindsay Parry and myself, the Coach Parry Training Club is the go-to online platform for your training needs. It's like having a coach in your pocket. Get 20% off when you join the Coach Parry Training Club by using the coupon code KONA at checkout. Head over to thekonaedge.com/coach or click on the link in your podcast player now. That's thekonaedge.com/coach.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for the Kona Edge.